He's the judge. He gets to decide that. Now, the Alaska Supreme Court gets to decide if he was right or wrong.
A state judge reverses the primary results in the Benjamin Nagiak Dean Westlake contest. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 6th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the controversy over the right-of-ways for the Donlin Creek gold mine proposal.
The prices of fuel and power and everything else in the region are very high, and there's no way they're ever going to come down unless you build something.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. More than 25,000 Alaskans are part of the Salmon Project family. Through stories, news, and a whole lot of salmon love, they're building a statewide community united by salmon. Find them on Facebook and join the conversation. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A judge today reversed the outcome of the Democratic primary for the House district that includes the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic boroughs. Superior Court Judge Andrew Guidi ordered the Division of Elections to certify that incumbent Benjamin Nagiak of Barrow won the primary over Dean Westlake of Kotzebue by a two-vote margin. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The outcome of the primary could determine who organizes a House majority. While both are Democrats, Nagiak caucuses with the Republican-led House majority, and Westlake says he'll caucus with the Democrats. The decision reverses the outcome of a recount, which had Westlake winning by 8 votes. Nagiak, who is the co-chairman of the House Resources Committee, expressed relief.
I'm pleased by the court's result, and hopefully it will be sustained during an appeal to the Supreme Court. I'm sure that's where it's going to go. And I hope the decision will result in an improvement of training.
The outcome hinges on the Kobuk River village of Shungnak, where local election officials wrongly allowed 50 voters to cast ballots in both the Republican primary and in the ADL primary for the Alaska Independence, Democratic, and Libertarian parties. Westlake led Nagiak in Shungnak 47 votes to 3 after the recount, but before the decision. Judge Guidi decided to subtract votes based on the average number of Shungnak residents who voted in Republican primaries over the past 10 years. Guidi subtracted 12 votes based on the idea that they would have voted Republican. He took away 11 votes from Westlake and Shungnak, as well as one from Nagiak. He also decided that election officials wrongly allowed both candidates to gain 1 vote from Kivalina in the recount. Westlake, who was out fishing, couldn't be reached for comment. His lawyer, Thomas Amadillo, says no votes should have been subtracted.
In our view, all of them were qualified. None should be disenfranchised. There's no evidence that any of them would have voted in anything but the ADL primary, especially with a very contested close race.
Amadillo argues that the competitive Democratic House race gave Republican voters more of a reason to cross over in the primary than they had in previous years when there were more competitive Republican statewide races. Amadillo says Guidi's decision effectively disenfranchises voters in a village that's 95% Alaska Native.
By his calculations, he's casting those aside. And that's, you know, he's the judge. He gets to decide that. Now, the Alaska Supreme Court gets to decide if he was right or wrong.
Under Guidi's decision, the final outcome would be 815 votes for Nagiak, 813 for Westlake. Nagiak says the small margin reinforces the importance of every voter.
Every vote counts. I mean, you know, we've been saying that for years, and it was borne out.
Division of Elections Director Josie Banky has said the division will use this year's primary experience to improve how the state trains election workers. The Supreme Court asked lawyers for Nagiak, Westlake, and the state to file briefs by Saturday. Oral arguments will be Wednesday, and the court is expected to rule by October 14th to give election officials enough time to distribute ballots for the November 8th election. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
14 U.S. senators sent a letter to President Obama today asking him to keep drill rigs out of federal waters in the Arctic forever. In recent months, environmentalists have been asking Obama to remove the Arctic from the five-year oil and gas leasing plan. Today's letter, though, asks the president to use a section of the Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Act to permanently exclude the Arctic and also the Atlantic from oil and gas leasing. No Republicans signed the letter. Vermont independent Bernie Sanders is the only non-Democrat on the list. A coalition of industry groups and Alaska unions has been campaigning to keep the Arctic in the five-year leasing plan, which the Interior Department is expected to release in November. Whatever the feds decide about Arctic leasing, it will not affect the big Smith Bay oil find Kalis Energy announced this week. That site is close to shore in state waters. The United States is trying to broker an agreement between a host of nations to prohibit unregulated fishing in the international waters of the Arctic Ocean. Such an agreement would piggyback on a non-binding agreement that the U.S. entered into with Norway, Denmark, Russia, and Canada last year to avoid fishing in the area. Admiral Robert Papp, the U.S. Special Representative for the Arctic, says a binding multinational agreement would prevent fishing in the Arctic high seas before scientists can determine what is sustainable. He says the issue is especially important as Arctic ice melts. The regulation of Arctic Ocean fishing is one of many Arctic issues being discussed this week at the Arctic Council's Senior Arctic Officials meeting taking place in Portland. ConocoPhillips has announced plans for a new drilling rig on the North Slope that will more than double the area it can develop from a single drill site. The company is calling it a potential breakthrough and says the rig will increase production by making development possible in areas that are currently hard to reach. It will allow Conoco to access an undeveloped field, Fjord West, from existing infrastructure. Fjord West was discovered in 1996. Conoco spokeswoman Natalie Lohman says the state would not have extended the company's Fjord West leases without the contract for the new rig. ConocoPhillips signed a contract with Doyon Drilling, which is under the Fairbanks-based Regional Native Corporation, to build the new rig. The rig will arrive in Alaska in 2020. To cut or tax? That is the conundrum state lawmakers are facing in the midst of a multi-billion dollar budget shortfall. There are options on the table, but consensus on a fix remains elusive. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, a recent study looked at how different scenarios would affect Alaska's short-term economy.
They're all going to have negative consequences on the economy.
That's Maseen Ghatabi. He's an assistant professor of economics at the Institute of Social and Economic Research.
I don't think that there is any way to avoid that.
He's speaking at the Fiscally Alaskan Summit, hosted by Alaska Common Ground. Ghatabi's study looks at some of the fiscal options available to close Alaska's budget gap and analyzes how each one could affect the statewide economy in the next year or two. The options are broken down into two categories: cuts and taxes. He says the option with the largest impact by far is cutting the state workforce.
The reason those numbers are so big is because we're starting by removing jobs directly from the economy, and then you're losing more jobs because those people are spending less money by eating out, by conducting their daily businesses. In every other option, there are no direct job losses.
Ghatabi says the state would need to cut between 1,400 and 1,600 jobs from its workforce to reduce the state deficit by $100 million. Among the tax options, reductions to the permanent fund dividend carry the largest impact, particularly among lower-income households.
The PFD represents a larger share of a lower-income person than it does a higher-income person, and lower-income individuals, typically speaking, tend to spend more of their income, right? And so you're taking a larger chunk of those people's incomes, and they tend to spend a lot of it. And so you're basically affecting the economy quite a bit because you're taking more money out of the economy when you impose a PFD cut.
According to Ghatabi's estimates, every $100 million injected into the state economy by the PFD supports between 560 and 900 jobs. These projections were made prior to this year's PFD cut, but he says if the $666 million cut from this year's PFD were distributed, it could mean the equivalent of more than 3,600 jobs over the next year and a half. He says that could take the form of new jobs, more hours for existing employees, or increases in benefits. The exact economic impact of the PFD varies depending on how much of it is injected directly into Alaska's economy instead of online purchases or other spending outside the state. And Katabi says no matter which options are ultimately chosen to close Alaska's budget gap, the effects will be felt much differently depending on what part of the state you're in.
Some economies are very, very dependent on oil and gas jobs or state government jobs. And when you do that, you have very different multiplier effects, right? And so we have some communities whose whole economy rests on the health of state and local government, for example. And if those sectors were to take a big hit, then the retail sector would be much more affected than, for example, in Anchorage.
Katabi says weighing the pros and cons of cuts versus taxes and the impacts each will have on different regions should be considered as the state works to close its budget gap.
And that's probably more of a political question than an economics question.
Katabi stresses that this study only looks at the short-term impacts of the various scenarios before people and businesses have a chance to adapt to the new fiscal landscape. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a panel discussion on the difficult topic of sexual assault.
And there's also what we do talk about, which I would call messages of shame and messages of blame.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The historic Iditarod Trail took center stage in yesterday's meeting held by the Army Corps of Engineers on the proposed Donlin Creek gold mine. Johanna Yurick reports the route has been changed, but not far enough for some longtime mushers.
The Iditarod Trail is a National Historic Trail. There's no getting around that. And after Donlin Gold's original plan proposing a natural gas pipeline through Rainy Pass raised a storm of objections from some in the dog mushing community, the route of the proposed buried gas line from Cook Inlet now swings north over the Alaska Range through Jones Pass. This route was used to avoid Rainy Pass, but it does not go far enough. According to Dan Seavey, one of the pioneer mushers who created the last great race and worked hard to get the trail its National Historic Trail designation, he notes the gas line would still follow the trail route from Skwentna to Finger Lake.
I don't see any mitigation. I see selecting an alternate to the historic trail.
Many other dog mushers weren't at the meeting because there's a gag order on those who plan to run the race. Donlin is a major race sponsor. The Army Corps of Engineers are trying to find ways to mitigate the problem posed by the gas line and other parts for the huge mine project. Sheila Newman with the Alaska District of the Army Corps thinks with enough people at the table, a solution can be found. She hopes that the Seavey family will continue to be involved.
I think there might be a broader context of what he's talking about, the trail and the actual 400-foot wide corridor. Can it be moved out of that 400-foot corridor? It's something that we'll definitely investigate further. I think that that's a continuing conversation we need to have.
Donlin points to community archaeological projects like the one recently conducted at Cripple Creek, the nearest village to the mine site, as a method to help mitigate problems. But as far as moving the pipeline right away off the trail route, Enrique Fernandez, senior environmental coordinator for Donlin Gold, says the reason it runs along the Iditarod Trail to the Alaska Range is the geography of the region.
It offers the best geotechnical conditions to place the pipeline, which is coincidental, the reasons also why the Iditarod Trail is there.
There are those who say the company needs to build connections between its proposed gas line and nearby villages. David Galilek Sr. from Akiak says he doesn't see any reason to build it if it does not improve the infrastructure to deliver more affordable gas for local residents.
They shouldn't actually build a pipeline if it's not going to benefit at least the region. You know, because we're the most economically, electrically, socially depressed region in the state.
June McAtee, Vice President of Lands and Shareholder Services for Calista, holder of the subsurface rights, says the Donlin Gold Mine is not a social service, but it is good business, and Donlin's proposed pipeline would bring affordable natural gas that much closer to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
The prices of fuel and power and everything else in the region are very high, and there's no way they're ever going to come down unless you build something. That's where we're coming from, and we think this project has the potential to help us get things built in the region.
But even if all these issues are resolved, some village residents worry that the pipeline will open remote areas to outside hunters. David Galilak Sr. says the temporary road used to build the gas line won't stay temporary, even if the company tries to close it, and that would have consequences for Akiak.
They will be coming in from all over the world. It is a whole lot cheaper to drive than to fly. Yeah, I mean, we'll have a lot of traffic in that area, eventually to the point where the state will have to call it a road.
The Army Corps of Engineers plans to hold another meeting on the issue in Bethel by the end of the month or early November. I'm Johanna Urich.
Bed bugs have been found at some University of Alaska Fairbanks residences. According to a letter UAF issued yesterday by vice chancellors, bed bugs have been confirmed in several apartments in Harwood Hall and in single units at Garden Apartments and Hess Village. It's believed that the bugs were introduced via furniture brought in from off campus. The university has hired an exterminator to treat the affected buildings. So far this year, 10 nursing homes in Alaska have been cited more than 100 times for health or safety shortfalls, according to state and federal inspection reports. The state has some of the highest rates of nursing home deficiencies in the nation, according to ProPublica. But Alaska inspectors say context is important. KTOO's Lakhidra Chavis reports.
Alaska nursing homes are inspected on the state and federal level annually to make sure they're meeting regulations. Brendan Vincent runs the state's program that oversees health facilities licensing compliance, which includes nursing homes.
And then we use tools of observation, interviews, record reviews, all just to ensure that they're being compliant and following state and federal regulations and ensuring that the best care is delivered to the residents in those facilities.
Angela Rick has been inspecting nursing homes for 8 years. She says that over time, there are some things that nursing homes are repeatedly cited for.
Our most common ones would be dignity of the resident. So making sure that it's a home-like environment and the resident's treated in a manner that you would want to be treated or your family member treated. Infection control would be a common deficiency.
Rick says high turnover among nursing home staffers can contribute to some of the inconsistencies.
We used to say that you're only as good as your worst performer, so it's very, very difficult sometimes to monitor what the staff is doing. And so one person could make a mistake or could have a practice, and that would cause you to get a deficiency in that area.
According to data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, inspectors logged 147 deficiencies at the 10 Alaska nursing homes visited so far this year. Alaska has a total of 18. Brendan Vincent says although the number of citations is high, the goal is to keep these institutions accountable. After each inspection, nursing home administrators are required to submit a plan of correction, which surveyors review.
And if we find a deficiency, we need to bring that forward to the facility and let them know. You know, if you don't, then change isn't going to be made. And that's important. I mean, if you see something wrong, it needs to be corrected. If you don't bring it to the light, then it just stays uncorrected.
Nursing homes with severe deficiencies can rack up penalties. Since 2013, the agencies have fined nursing homes more than $100,000 or denied Medicare and Medicaid payments. For the Prestige Care and Rehabilitation Center in Anchorage, the problems were so bad that the state took control over the facility last year to address the issues. After a national investigation into nursing home safety, ProPublica ranked the states with the most severe deficiencies in nursing homes. Their most recent data ranks Alaska as the fourth worst. Becky Holtberg is the president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, which lobbies for its members. She says inspection reports are just one of the ways to measure nursing home care.
Well, as an example, there are several CMS quality measures where Alaska skilled nursing facilities have better outcomes than most facilities in other states. Specifically, Alaska does very well in preventing falls, reducing the use of antipsychotics, and successfully managing the use of physical restraint.
She says Alaska is a small state with a small number of nursing homes, and that calls the attention of federal regulators.
I would note that there are times where we have more surveyors in a facility than we have residents. The ProPublica data was not a huge surprise to me.
And Juno, I'm Lakita Chavez.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
You may not have heard it, but KYUK has added a new service in its Yupik News programming. The Bethel Public Radio Station is now airing news from around the world in Yupik. Their targeted audience includes elders and people in the region who have Yupik as their primary language. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Good morning, Agluchi.
That is KYUK's translator John Arumgachik Active introducing his new show featuring world news translated to Yupik. Active translates news stories from around the world. He says it's mainly for the elders who watch TV news at home.
When they hear and watch the news on TV, they ask their family members, where is this happening? What is happening? How is it happening? Why is it happening? I mainly considered those guys when we started this show.
KYUK already airs local and state news every weekday on mornings after 8 a.m., noon a little after 12, and in the evenings around 5:30 p.m. Shane Iverson, KYUK's general manager, came up with the idea for the show.
The idea was just to expand that to make sure our Yupik audience is fully informed of all the big events happening in the world, and specifically people who speak Yupik as a first language, to make sure they hear the news in a language that makes the most sense to them.
The show started on Monday, September 26, but was not heavily promoted, so a few elders and Yupik speakers whom KYUK contacted were interested in the content but did not know the show existed. The show airs live on weekdays after the morning Yupik news and the Thunder Drums announcements. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
The difficult and painful topic of sexual assault and the trauma that follows will be the subject of a panel discussion tomorrow evening at the Anchorage Museum. The conversation will be held after a staged reading of a personal essay called White Horse, about a campus rape and the aftermath, written by Elise Goldbach and featured in the current issue of the Alaska Quarterly Review. English professor Heather Adams of the University of Alaska Anchorage will moderate the discussion. She says the idea is to provide a space for an audience to hear from experts and listen to personal stories.
It is a very traumatic experience that we'll be talking about as we then transition into a panel of experts who are coming from a variety of perspectives. There are people from UAA who will be speaking from their sort of professional standpoint. There's someone who's an expert in law. There are people who have kind of experienced this trauma themselves. So we're trying to have a balanced perspective and show our support in that way. And of course, we're inviting support from the UAA community and reaching out to some community partners to ensure that hopefully there will be support at the event that night, because this is a really sensitive topic. And of course, we know that holding an event like this means that we have to be prepared to give support, not just to talk about the ideas, but to deal with the emotional piece of it, the emotions that are raised.
Dr. Adams, you have written about the legacy of shame and secrecy, silence. And part of that is dealing with the shame that surrounds rape or unwanted pregnancies. Why do you think it is that shame still surrounds so much of what happens when there is a sexual assault? Why can't we change that?
There's both the silence that comes with not talking that we see in systematic underreporting of rape. And there's also what we do talk about, which I would call messages of shame and messages of blame. It's really hard to understand why those messages are so persistent. When I, years ago, learned about women who had to give a child away for adoption because they had that child out of wedlock, it was news to me. I didn't know about that, and I was horrified. And it's been really interesting as I continue my research to develop this argument through my research that actually what seems like it happened a long time ago, yes, the practices are a little bit different. We don't have homes for unwed mothers, but you're exactly right. This legacy of messages of shame and messages of blame, they really persist. I would say that one of the root causes is that we don't have models, we don't have support for women, especially young women, to talk about their sexuality, to understand sexuality and sex as a normal part of life. We have a lot of cultural taboo around that. We know in Alaska there's been a lot of effort to be really almost draconian about how sex education is delivered to our young people. And I just feel strongly that, you know, until we can really talk about these things openly, that's just one piece of the puzzle. Another big issue is consent. Consent is something that we talk about that sounds like it's a yes or a no. It's really more complicated. And I think that this White Horse event is one small way our community can come together. And I really hope our community comes together to, you know, just have a conversation around these really difficult topics. No one really likes to talk about these things, but we really have to if we want to shift that culture of silence and shame and blame.
Dr. Heather Adams is the moderator for a panel discussion of the essay White Horse at the Anchorage Museum tomorrow evening, beginning at 7 p.m. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Lakeed Rashavis in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Josh Edge, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
It's a fact. Over half of Alaska Native adults don't use tobacco. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message is sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization. Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.